This podcast is part of the Podcast Arcade Network.
Hello. Today, I've got John Holloway from the Worst Comic Podcast Ever on my show today. And we are going to be discussing Return of the Jedi. We'll talk about the background, the actors, the movie, and of course, the soundtrack. Today on Soundtrack Alley. John, it's great to have you on my show tonight.
Thanks a lot, Randy. It's great to be here. I appreciate you having me on, and I know you've had my other compatriots on the show as well, so it's nice to get on here myself.
Yeah, I was wondering how I would be able to get all three of you on at some point, and doing the Star Wars trilogy is actually a really nice way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we're suckers. I'm of the three of us, and I love Star Wars. I mean, I had all the action figures, and I eventually gave them to my nephew, but I had the land speeder. My land speeder was gunked up because we actually used to use it in actual sand.
Oh yeah.
And it turns out a land speeder, the toy land speeder, does not work very well on actual sand. It will gunk it up.
Yeah.
So just to warn everybody on that, you definitely don't want to do that. But when I would get together with Colin and Jerry and our friends to play the Trivial Pursuit Star Wars edition of Trivial Pursuit, their basic rule was you had to answer the whole card.
Oh.
You couldn't just answer one question. You had to answer all six questions, or else you weren't really worthy. I was definitely the least worthy. Those guys had memorized the credits.
Oh wow!
They knew who played Stormtrooper 87, and I was like, yeah, I'm not that good. So they're impressive. So I will try to be worthy here.
Oh yeah, I'm sure you are more than worthy to be able to bring out some points about Return of the Jedi. One of the things I really find is that with Return of the Jedi, with, it being directed by, it wasn't Kirshner, it was Richard Marquand.
Yeah,
Richard Marquand.
It wasn't Kirshner, who I think still is actually the best director of anybody in the Star Wars series.
Oh yeah.
Because to me, Empire is still, for me, my favorite movie.
Yeah.
And I've liked the two recent movies, but for everything that went into it and everything that happened, for me, you know, Empire. And I don't want to talk down Return of the Jedi, which we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
But I still think Empire benefited so much from Kirshner's direction, somebody other than George Lucas to bring that vision to life.
Oh yeah, I would have to agree, because I mean, it's one of my favorite movies. Return of the Jedi, it's up there, but it's not my all-time Star Wars favorite. So
correct. Yeah, me too.
So you know, there's different things that we learn from the production side of things, and it's so funny. Thinking about that, you know, Carrie Fisher recently died, and
right.
On the set, she had complained about her costumes in both previous movies. So she had said they were too long, or you couldn't tell she was a woman, and these complaints led to the skimpy outfit that she wore as Jabba's slave. And so that costume became something of a running joke among the crew, because the metal framework that held the top together meant that the costume didn't move well with her, and she didn't like the industry's standard solution that used double-sided tape, and it became necessary before each take to have a wardrobe person check to ensure that her breasts were still snug inside the costume top. So there were wardrobe malfunctions.
Here's the thing, Randy. Somebody got paid to do that.
Yeah.
That was somebody's job, was to get paid to make sure that Carrie Fisher's breasts were adequately taped inside her costume. That was a job.
Yeah. Yep.
And I can't believe that that was an actual thing that somebody got paid for. I think, and it's funny because she also gave George some trouble at times because she wasn't allowed in any of her costumes. She didn't wear a brassiere.
No.
And she gave him a lot of trouble about, because he said, well, there's not going to be brassieres in space or whatever. It's just the most bizarre explanation of all time. But, you know, he made it work.
Oh, yeah, he did. He definitely did. One of the actors that I really find was so key to a lot of the action for Return of the Jedi, as well as, I mean, you look back or you look forward to when they filmed the prequels, Ian McDermott. I mean, Ian McDermott made it to where his scenes as the Emperor in Return of the Jedi were so iconic that, you know, he embodied that character. What do you think about that?
Yeah, for sure. And I think he, up until that point, Vader is, you know, we haven't seen really Vader and the Emperor together. We've seen Vader go in front of the hologram projection of the Emperor, but we haven't really seen them together. And because in Star Wars, Darth Vader is, for a lot of us who were young at that time, he becomes our ultimate villain. I mean, Darth Vader is the personification of villainy.
Yeah.
And then you see the Emperor, and all of a sudden, he is a guy who takes it up to 11. Like, if Vader was at 10, the Emperor is at 11, because he's just playing Vader like a fiddle, and just everything, like, he just seems so invincible. But it isn't just that he's evil, it's that he loves being evil.
Yeah.
Like, he just relishes being evil. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes him such a villain. But he does it without going over the top, because normally that kind of villainy just becomes almost comedic.
Yeah.
It becomes like such a joke or so ridiculous that you can't even take it seriously. But with him, Vader seems to somehow become worse temporarily. Like, Vader becomes sad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that Vader just isn't even in control. Like, that he's just like, he'd like to help Luke. You know, there's a moment in Return where, you know, Luke comes to him and Vader wants to let him go. And you can tell that he's torn. But man, I got to turn you into the man, because Vader's not in control of himself when the Emperor's around. And that's at least, you know, up until obviously the end. And I think that's, you know, McDermott makes that role so believable and evil without turning it over the top to make it comedic.
Yeah. And, you know, with with Empire Strikes Back, you know, they had the person that came on, I think his name was Clive Revell, who had portrayed the Emperor's voice in Empire Strikes Back. That was before the special edition, when they had changed everything. McDermott, he felt that he could conduct a stronger, more wicked voice for the Emperor as opposed to Revel's more aristocratic Emperor. And so both George Lucas and Steven Spielberg were so impressed with his take that it ended up being a signature trait of his character. So
yeah, I mean, the voice of the Emperor is so, you know, and you know, you watch the Simpsons even to a lot of degree, sort of Mr. Burns kind of has that sort of older voice, but there's this evilness that's underneath it too. And And I think we've all kind of done that impression of the emperor. It's a voice that you easily can call up.
Yeah.
And that's what made, you know, that's part of what makes it so iconic.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the funny things about the emperor and, say, his chair that he had in the, in his high spire, apparently. I would assume it's a spire, but it's on the Death Star, so I don't know what it would be classified as. But that chair was supposed to be mechanized, and it was supposed to be able to rotate when the scene called for it, but it never worked properly. So Ian McDermott had to make it move by shuffling his feet. And so there was a piece of tape on the floor when it told him to stop. And it was just, it was hilarious, but you can never visibly see him move his feet to turn the chair.
And that's just kind of classic movie magic. I mean, that's what you would have done back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, you would have just had the person rotate the chair, and that's what you did. That's movie magic. And in some ways, I feel like, you know, we get so impressed with this technological terror we've constructed. We, you know, we sometimes go to a technological solution when one isn't really necessary.
Yeah.
You know, you have somebody design it, you set it up so that it swivels, and you go from there. Mm-hmm. And so that's just a classic movie. I'm sure that younger people were probably aghast at, oh my gosh, that's so hilarious that they had to do that.
Yeah.
And older actors are like, that's what you do. That's yeah. That's how you make movies. You know,
you make
just
it work.
Make sure that doesn't show up on screen.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's those little things that actually make it seem more real. And one thing that made me chuckle when I was doing some research was, you know, with the opening sequence, and you see, you know, the Jabba's sail barge, and that it was filmed in Yuma, Arizona. Well, mm-hmm. they had a real problem with dune buggy enthusiasts. And so to preserve the secrecy of the film, they kept on making these horror references, calling it Blue Harvest. And that it was horror beyond imagination. And they even had caps and t-shirts made, and even a chain link fence and 24-hour security sometimes didn't prevent fans from entering the scene and sneaking some photographs. But another reason for the guys was Blue Harvest was to put off any snoopers, because the production found that if they mentioned that they were working on the next Star Wars film, suppliers would automatically ramp up their prices, assuming that the money was no object. But I thought it was kind of funny, because it's like a later point that I had found was they had used that very jab of the name Blue Harvest when they brought out the Family Guy movie, and they called it Star Wars Blue Harvest or something. I thought that was kind of funny.
Very nice touch. Very nice touch. Yeah, and that seems to be even more and more. You know, obviously movie stuff is very secretive, but partially because now, you know, back in the day, you're out in your dune buggy and you're out there, and maybe you get a peek at something, you get a picture on your camera, but literally at that time, you would then have to take that film, go get it developed, go find somebody to buy it. It's a grainy picture from who knows how far away.
Yeah.
You know, now it's a digital picture. You can get a high res, and it's on the internet in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And it's done. You can't control that anymore.
Mm-mm.
So it's such a different thing. And now you see, you know, they've got to cover up everybody and make sure when you see things from like the Star Trek movies, you know, everybody's very covered and everything's very hush hush. And it's amazing how controlled all that is.
Oh, yeah. And even, you know, even with the new Star Wars movies, it seems like there's still a very much high secrecy about those movies, because people have their theories and everything, but there's no pictures released. There's nothing. And so it's got to be like a super closed set to be able to keep that kind of secrecy going.
Well, I think sometimes it's also a control. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's also a control of, partially information, but it's partially also, you get a picture out and maybe the picture looks bad. And maybe because it's an early version, maybe they're still working on it. Maybe they're going to do some work in post-production with digital effects or whatever. But you get a picture out and the picture looks bad and people start bashing the movie before it's even come out. And yeah, you get this negative connotation and people are already writing the reviews of the movie before they've even seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to control some of those expectations and information before that stuff comes out.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point, because otherwise everything's out in the open, and like today, everything can be, and it's on the internet instantly. So they have to really, really control those sequences, or just keeping the set very hush hush. So yeah, one of the things I found interesting, as you, of course, are part of the worst comic podcast ever. You deal with comics a lot. One of the interesting characters in Return of the Jedi is the fact that Boba Fett meets his doom. And yet, after Return of the Jedi came out, Boba Fett appeared in comics and became a very popular supporting character. Now, how do you feel about Boba Fett becoming that iconic bounty hunter figure in comics?
Well, here's the thing. Boba Fett was a character that we all thought was awesome. Like, and so a big part of it was, obviously, we didn't want Boba Fett to kill Han or Luke or anything. But on the other hand, you know, seeing Boba Fett die, you know, taken down in the way he was, to go down in the way he did, was also pretty disappointing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think a lot of us are like, come on, man, you can't just have, that's not how Boba Fett dies. Like, if Boba Fett dies, it's got to be awesome and epic. You can't just have him die like that. So different things showed him sort of, like, in the comics, they'd show him crawling out mm-hmm. of the Sarlacc pit and different things. I'm fine with that. I mean, here's the thing. Like, we're comic book guys. In comic books, no one's ever dead.
No.
Like, people are only dead as long as it serves the story.
Mm-hmm.
You need them alive, you come in, it's like soap operas and everything. You kill somebody off, then you renegotiate their contract, and hey, look, they're alive again. It's weird.
Yeah.
So I've got no problem with that, because I think we all thought Boba Fett was, you know, was super cool.
Yeah.
So I'm good with it.
That's good. Did you ever read any of the Boba Fett comics that had come out through Dark Horse?
I wasn't a big Star Wars comic book guy.
Mm-hmm.
I would read something every once in a while. They did a great one that was like an alternate reality one,
mm-hmm.
where Leia was on the dark side. She worked with the Empire, and there was all kinds of stuff. And I've read a couple other about some of the other Jedi and some other bounty hunters and things like that. I think there was a Darth Vader versus Boba Fett
mm-hmm.
Dark Horse little four-issue story
yep.
that I got that was really good. But I wasn't a big, so I mean, I read some of it, but I wasn't a super huge Star Wars comic book guy. For whatever reason, I just never quite got into it.
Oh, well, you know, that's perfectly fine, because, you know, everybody has their thing, and I think sure. I've read maybe a few of the older Star Wars comics that came out through Dark Horse. I read Dark Empire and Dark Empire
yes.
2, and those were really unique, because it saw Luke in a different light and different way of looking at his character, but the artwork to it was terrible.
It wasn't the best. It
yeah.
wasn't the best artwork, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And which was too bad, because I'm a sucker for alternate reality, mm-hmm. alternate version sort of comics, where you take something and you kind of play the what if game. I love that stuff. But yeah, that series, the artwork on that series did not make me think, you know, I need to get a bunch more of Star Wars comics, unfortunately.
Oh.
And that's tricky because you want to be able to, you got something that maybe you think is going to attract readers, but you don't have maybe the artist you like at the time, but you got to go with the story. You've already paid the writer or something. So I don't know. Some of those things are a little bit tricky to manage, but I thought that was a very cool idea. And mm-hmm. I hadn't seen it much from Star Wars. I'd seen it from other stuff, but I hadn't seen it much from Star Wars stuff before. So I thought that was a really cool, that was a really cool touch.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's a unique way of looking at the characters. And you see the, you know, with Return of the Jedi, you see Luke presenting himself in dark clothing. And you really wonder, is he going toward the dark side or what? And yet he is very clearly a Jedi, but, you know, his clothing doesn't represent that. I always found it unique with the posters that came out before the movie of Return of the Jedi that originally it had been titled Revenge of the Jedi.
Right.
But the producers, you know, of course, thought that Jedis wouldn't seek revenge due to their ethical code. And even some posters and stand-ups, they had to be pulled because it wasn't that. You know, and even with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which will be a further episode down the line on my podcast, was originally going to be called Star Trek Revenge of Khan. But they changed it to avoid confusion with the movie back when Revenge of the Jedi was being considered. So I thought that was kind of unique in the way the posters would reflect the Revenge of the Jedi, and that it was, you know, that red poster with Luke and Darth Vader fighting, and the outline was of Darth Vader's face. So it was unique. And then do you remember one of the posters that came out where you see the two hands holding the lightsaber?
Yeah, I do remember that, but I don't remember who was it supposed to be. Who was it supposed to be?
It was George Lucas's hands.
Oh my gosh.
So I thought that was kind of funny to find that out.
That sounds a little bit like George Lucas to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of one of those funny points. And when we think about even like David Prowse with being Darth Vader, he was kind of bummed out that Sebastian Shaw was going to be the character that was going to be unmasked at the end. He was just kind of upset that it wouldn't have been him that would be under the mask, but I guess they wanted a different look to how Vader would actually look as a human. So, you know, it's unique how they change certain aspects of the characters and how those actors have to roll with the punches, so to speak.
Well, Prowse, I know, didn't know, and maybe you guys talked about this on the Empire episode. I haven't heard that one. I haven't listened to that one yet. But that, you know, during the scene in Empire where, you know, Luke, he didn't kill your, you know, he didn't kill your father. I am your father. You mm-hmm. know, that sort of classic scene. Prowse didn't know
yeah.
that those were the lines until he saw the movie.
Yeah.
It was literally at the movie that he found that out. And he asked, you know, he sort of apparently turned to Lucas during the movie and was just like, why didn't you just tell me that that's what you want? I would have acted differently.
Yeah. Yeah.
If that's what you wanted. But they were that, and Luke and Mark Hamill didn't find out until right before, Mark Hamill didn't know until right before they shot that scene.
Yeah.
That Vader was going to be his father. And so it was amazing how secret they kept stuff even from the cast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. There's so many different things that, you know, wasn't brought out for the cast because they wanted to keep things so silent. But that thing with David Prowse was just, you know, kind of upsetting for him because he wanted to be the one that would be unmasked. One of the unique things that I found interesting was, you know, we hear about the planets of the universe of Star Wars, and with Return of the Jedi, you hear about basically the home world of the Senate and government of the Empire, but they never really gave it a name in the movie, but they had rolled it around in their heads of saying that it would be this planet named Had Abaddon. And it wasn't until 1991 that, with Timothy Zahn releasing Heir to the Empire for his Empire trilogy, he had brought out the name Coruscant. And so George Lucas really liked that name, and so he used it further with the prequel trilogy. So I found that really interesting.
I did not know that, and it's funny that you mentioned it, because I really liked his Thrawn series.
Yeah.
Of books, I thought was one of my favorite series of the Star Wars books, and that's interesting that came from there. I would not, like, in my mind, Coruscant was what it was called, but I guess I, for whatever reason, I didn't connect that didn't happen in the movies, that it didn't happen until the books came out. That's funny.
Yeah, and I mean, it made sense once the prequels came out, because those weren't until 1999. But
right.
With the Thrawn trilogy coming out in 1991, apparently George Lucas was even a fan of those books. And Timothy Zahn, you know, he still gets credit for inventing Thrawn, because now he's being used in Star Wars Rebels. So,
right, exactly.
But, of course, you know, we're going off on a tangent. So, what is your best highlight of Return of the Jedi?
For me, the big highlight, unfortunately, comes early in the movie. It's Luke having coordinated this whole escape thing, and it all coming together over the Sarlacc pit, and us finally getting to see Luke do some Jedi stuff. Because so far, Luke's been kind of, I mean, yes, at the very end of Star Wars, he makes the shot with his X-Wing after, you know, getting bailed out by Han. But most of that movie, he's the dumb farm kid who, you know, he's the rube who doesn't really get what's going on. In Empire, he, you know, we see him train with Yoda, but mostly he's whiny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's this super whiny kid. He manages to get out of the cave, you know, the ice cave, and but again, he gets saved by Han.
Yeah.
And then he goes to fight Vader and gets his butt kicked. So Luke's kind of been, you know, the kicking, he's been the guy who got kicked around a lot. And when we were kids, my brother always was Han, and I was always Luke when we would play.
Yeah.
So I've been waiting for this third movie, finally, for Luke to finally become, you know, the top-notch guy.
Yeah.
And it's taken Luke a while to develop, but over the Sarlacc pit, we see him being pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And we get to see him go through, and even when he comes in, you know, at first when he arrives at Jabba's palace and he you know, force chokes a couple of the big pig-looking creatures away and uses his mind tricks to get in to see Jabba and all that. That first half an hour of the movie is really Luke being pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And so for me, that was the part that I really wanted to see was that part. Was Luke finally getting to do some Jedi stuff.
Yeah, and even when he got thrown down into the Sarlacc, or not the Sarlacc, but the Rancor pit,
right.
He faces off against, you know, a giant monster that, of course, is not very big because it's a puppet. But
right.
The unique thing about that is that they play it so well. And that part of it is animatronic, to where they have a giant claw actually hold him and, you know, have it be brought up so it looks like he's actually being carried by the Rancor. But one of the things I found about the Rancor is that the guttural sounds and grunts and growls were actually made by a dachshund.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was a dog.
They're fierce, man.
Yeah.
They're fierce.
And they're fierce little animals.
I know. They're little guys, but they pack a punch. How about for you? What was your highlight on the movie?
Oh, my highlight would have to be the speeder chase in the forest of Endor. That's like one of my highlighted scenes in that entire movie, and getting them on those speeder bikes and chasing the stormtroopers through the forest and the scout troopers, and just the different, I mean, it always made me wonder, how did they get these to look like they're going so fast? And then, like, as I was doing research, I found that they would walk through the forest at a normal speed with a video camera and get these footage of, you know, going through this California forest, and then they'd speed up the film to make it look really, really fast. But that scene has always impressed me, and always even shown that Luke could get by without having his lightsaber or being able to use his lightsaber, but still be able to be a Jedi. I found that, you know, that's just one of my all-time favorite scenes in that movie.
Yeah, for sure.
So then we come to the thought of what is your least favorite.
For me, that's tricky. I mean, I wasn't a huge fan, especially at the time, and I know I'm not the only one, of the Ewoks.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm just going to lay it out. I thought the Ewoks took a lot of time in the movie.
Yeah.
That could have been spent more interestingly. And my understanding is that they were originally going to do that. They were going to have Wookiees.
Yeah.
It was going to be this planet of Wookiees, but they couldn't afford, you know, it was going to be expensive. And so they went the other way and they went short. And I get it. It's cute and everything. But, you know, part of it is you've got these teddy bears with all this stuff rigged up in the forest. Like, who are they fighting? Like, how do they already have these logs all set up to fight all these stormtroopers and these walkers? Like, what were they normally doing with them? Like, no, they have no purpose. So they rigged all that up in the, you know, hour or whatever they had to do this. It just seemed a little bit crazy to me that they did all this. And it's kind of like in the remake of The Magnificent Seven, and they set up a whole village to have all this stuff and everything. And like, we've got a day. Okay, let's build, let's dig an 8-mile trench and do all this other stuff. It's like, I'm sorry. No.
Yeah.
Not going to happen. So, I'm gonna go with the Ewoks.
Okay. I still go back and forth with what is my least favorite thing about Return of the Jedi, and I would have to say some of the things with the Ewoks were, you know, it was very kind of bland to me, because I mean, you've got these tiny little creatures fighting against the Empire, and the only way they're able to win is because of the rebels. And so I think that side of it made me like those scenes better, because you get Chewie going off and actually capturing one of the AT-STs, and that's one of the fun moments in that forest battle, being able to see that. I mean, it's just, you know, really impressive, and I found it really interesting that, you know, with getting so many smaller actors to be able to do those roles, small people to be able to do the roles of the Ewoks, such as Warwick Davis and Kenny Baker and several other actors that I can't remember, but they've used in movies like Time Bandits. And I mean, sure, they went through a lot of work to be able to make them believable and have them be this forest of these small creatures. And I mean, we get a really good movie out of that whole story by the Caravan of Courage. I mean, you know, that TV movie that had come out after Return of the Jedi, because it was basically, you know, the Ewoks on this adventure trying to go up against this giant monster that had captured these kids' parents. I just find it, you know, unique that their whole society was built better by having that background story.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And I think that fleshed it out and made it a little more different. And don't get me wrong, I also have a special place for the Ewoks in my heart. When Jerry and Cullen and I were, you know, we were all in high school together. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we did in high school our senior year, and we did it a few times, is we would actually come up to the school really early, and we would park in the senior parking lot, and we would bring up a grill. And we actually would grill steaks before school.
Oh.
We actually hung out in the parking lot. We had a tailgate. Before school, we had a little grill with steaks and like beans and stuff, and we would play the Return of the Jedi soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
And so, which for the most part, the only part we could sing along with was the Ewok part.
Mm-hmm. The parade of the Ewoks.
Yeah, chub chub, e chub, and up whoop. And man, we could sing. We knew all of the Ewok lines to that.
You know.
I've still got a little Ewok love there. Don't get me wrong.
There's an interesting point about that whole music cue. Did you know that Joseph Williams, who is one of the lead singers of the band Toto, he was consulted with he also helped compose those very pieces of music, and he is the son of John Williams.
No kidding.
Yes.
That is awesome. I did not know that.
Yeah. So I was really more or less flabbergasted because I didn't realize that he was actually involved.
I didn't know that John Williams had a son. The funny part of this is I was actually listening on Spotify to some 80s music earlier, and I actually earlier today the song Africa by Toto came on my station. So this is all just coming together, man. This is karma.
Yeah. But it's unique, you know, because there are some very specific images that you get when you hear the music for Return of the Jedi. There's the very specific point where Luke faces off at the Sarlacc pit. There's the point where the Rebel fleet is going before they head out to the Death Star. You get that amazing action cue that's just like, it builds and builds and you're like, hey, yeah, let's do this. And then, you know, the different cues for the Battle of Endor with John Williams' music. It's just, it's so impressive because he's able to weave this story so well. And he's built it over three films. And so you get this wonderful piece of music that just flows really well.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, a big part of Return of the Jedi is while there is new music, and obviously it's scored, so much of it is about hitting familiar notes. And both in the movie, there's so many callbacks to things that have happened earlier. Whether it's, you know, Han's like, how are we doing? And Luke's, you know, about the same as normal. Oh, that bad.
Yeah.
And then later on where, Leia reveals that she's got a gun and Han says, I love you. And she says, I know. I mean, there's so many great, and obviously everything with R2-D2 and C-3PO at that point is just on autopilot. I mean, you just know that what they're going to do before they do it. Which is partly what's so familiar and great about it, because the characters are so familiar that it's like an old friend who fills in the line that you don't have yet. And so that's part of what I love about it. Probably for me, one of the most emotional pieces of music in the movie is during the scene where Luke reveals to Leia, A, that they're brother and sister, and B, that Vader is not only Luke's father, but Leia's father.
Yes.
And that is a very, very powerful scene in that movie.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, and one that I love so much, And I was hoping we were going to get to see, and I don't, you know, I don't totally know what episode eight holds, but, you know, I was very much looking forward to a Luke Leia reunion.
Well, I think that will happen.
And I think it may, because I know they've already shot a lot of the movie.
Yeah. And they've shot all Leia scenes, so.
Right, and if that's the music that they play, I could, especially knowing that Carrie Fisher is gone, if they play that music, I'll be gone. Like, I'll be a wreck. I just say yeah. Right now, the tears are going to fall.
Yeah.
I'm not ashamed. Like, that's just going to happen. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that right now. So.
But it really shows that the music for even Return of the Jedi has that heart, that emotion behind it that really can draw us into the characters and really see that these are, you know, characters that can be flawed and that have problems. And, you know, even when they get Lando and Admiral Ackbar, and when they get to Endor and they find out that the shield's still up, and then they're trapped by the Star Destroyers, and then Ackbar says, "It's a trap!" You know, we see that there's these flaws in the characters that it's like, we gotta give them more time. So.
Yeah, exactly. No, there's, and I think, you know, part of it is in that movie there, you know, we know everything's gonna go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we know nothing's gonna go according to plan. Like, whatever the plan is, that's not what's gonna happen. And that's true of a lot of movies. But here you just expect it. I mean, every time the Millennium Falcon doesn't go to light speed and Leia rolls her eyes, and you know, every time the plan doesn't work out right and it's really a trap, like you're not, of course it's a trap.
Mm-hmm.
Of course it is. but the, you know, in some ways the bad guys are taken down by their own hubris and and by just the rebels being willing to make sacrifices. We're going to sacrifice some ships. If we're going to take the Death Star down, we got to do it now. We got to give them more time. So, and you know, to see you know, it's not Han and Chewie in the Millennium Falcon is, a different thing. We're not used to seeing somebody else in there. And but I mean, it's Lando. I mean, Lando's is very Han-like.
Yeah.
I mean, these two guys are pretty darn similar, so.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, with the result of Empire Strikes Back as well as Return of the Jedi, we got the Lando Calrissian adventures from Brian Daley, I believe. He had written three separate stories that tied together to give us some background on Lando.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. And because Lando is a character who we haven't seen a lot of his background. We don't know a lot from the movies. You know, we know he has this connection with Han. We get this impression that he's a you know, kind of a scoundrel, a little bit of, you know, definitely kind of a player, kind of a hustler. And so I'm very interested to see how things work in the young Han Solo movie.
Yes.
How much we learn about Lando. Will he be an important character in the movie? Is he just going to be there to kind of add a little background? Or my guess is that we're going to see how Han gets the Millennium Falcon, and how he gets it from Lando.
Yeah, maybe we'll finally get to see what the game of Sabacc actually, how it's played.
Right, exactly. Right. How does that go down? And how desperate Lando must have been to have wagered the Millennium Falcon. That seems to me to be a pretty big bet.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. When we look at certain scenes in the movie, how did the death scene of Yoda affect you?
You know, I think I felt sad, but you know, he leaves us with this revelation that there's another, and he leaves Luke really as far as we know, the last Jedi, even though he says there's another, but there's another Skywalker, you know, there's another Skywalker, and to pass on what you've learned. And I, you know, there's a sadness there because I loved puppet Yoda.
Yeah.
And watching the prequels, I'll be honest, I don't love CGI Yoda.
Yeah.
And I know people are like, well, we want to be able to do this and this, and I get it. It's cool to see Yoda bounce around and do all that stuff. But to be honest, I thought Puppet Yoda was so incredibly well done.
Yeah.
And I thought they shot it well. Frank Oz did an awesome job. And so for me, it was very sad, but I also knew it was something that had to happen. You've done it twice to Luke. You know, in the hero's journey, the classic hero's journey, that's part of it, is you take away the teacher, mm-hmm. and you leave the hero has to go on his own. And we've done this with Luke twice.
Yeah,
we've taken away Obi-Wan, and now we've taken away Yoda. And that's what you had to do. Luke's now got to be on his own. He's got to go. He can't. He's got to defeat Vader and the Emperor by himself. That's the only way that the hero's journey works. And so for me, it was sad, but it was 100% necessary.
Yeah, I would definitely agree, because it pushed him to do what he needed to do. Actually, become the Jedi that he needed to be. It made it a much more meaningful scene to show that Yoda, you know, he didn't die of, you know, being stabbed by a lightsaber. He actually died of natural right. causes. So it's like, this is a natural course for him.
Yeah, and I think so. It was just time for him to go. I think it was time. I think he realized it was time for him to step out of the way. And you know, I didn't get the idea that it was totally like just whatever. I mean, I think it was his time to go, and he went out in control.
Yeah,
you know, of what he wanted. So, it was a necessary part of the movie. It was the transition that Luke needed to be able to go and take the next step and to fully be a Jedi.
Yeah, and so one of the things that I'd like to encourage you to do is go back and listen to my Empire Strikes Back episode, because there's a really funny tidbit that I shared with Colin about Irvin Kershner and his directing habits. So I will leave that in the air so you can listen to it.
Okay, all right. Very good. I look forward to that.
But yeah, so, you know, we've talked a lot about the characters in the film and different scenes that have affected us. And we've even, you know, discussed a little bit of the music that John Williams puts out for Return of the Jedi. So what I'd like to do is, I've got a few cues that I'd like to play for us. The first cue I have is playing the Pit of Carcoon Sail Barge Assault. And so I'd like to ask you, what do you think of the music that we're about to play? And, you know, how does the scenes in the movie help with the music?
For me, you know, this is an action scene. And it's a really important action scene, because after this scene, we don't get much action for a while. The movie really kind of gets slow for a little bit in the middle. And so you got to have this big emotional swell, but you've been building up to it. You've been told they're going to digest in the pit of the Sarlacc for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And so you've really got to build this up, and you don't know what's going to happen, because Luke seems strangely confident. Mm-hmm. Like, his confidence seems disproportionate to the situation. Like it just seems all bluff, you know, let me go now or else you're going to die and regret it. And you've got so many things going on. You've got R2 on the barge electrocuting the little rat creature. You've got Leia, who's got to get her revenge against Jabba for being just gross and disgusting. You've got Han and Chewie and Lando there. They've got Boba Fett they've got to deal with, while Luke kind of directs the whole thing. So there's just so much going on, and the music just plays into that. It just keeps building and ramping it up and ramping it up. Just when you think you can't add anything to the action, there's another thing that adds on.
Yeah.
And the music just plays into that whole aspect of it by just building up and building up. And you don't even know that you're doing it. You're grabbing your arms or your chair, and you're just getting pulled into it. You don't notice. It's one of those scenes, like quiet scenes, you tend to notice the music.
Yeah.
And action scenes, you don't maybe tend to notice the music as much until you go back and you make a specific effort to listen to the music. You listen to the music, and then all of a sudden, like, oh my gosh, I can see everything that's happening in this scene just by listening to the music because it so mirrors everything that's going on.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those iconic scenes, and as you brought out earlier, it's one of your favorite scenes in the movie.
Absolutely.
So now we'll play The Pit of Carcoon and Sail Barge Assault.
We'll be right back.
So the next cue I'd like to play is the speeder bike chase and Land of the Ewoks. I really love how this action cue brings Luke and Leia into this amazing speeder bike chase. What do you think about it, John?
For me, the speeder bike chase is another thing. It's just frantic. It's just this crazy scene, and it's almost hard to process how anybody would steer through this without the Force.
Yeah.
Like, I get if you've got the Force, how you can know every G that's coming up. But if you're just a regular schlep riding around in one of those stormtrooper helmets with no peripheral vision, like, I'm sorry, I don't even know how you do that. That's just crazy. And so, so for me, this was just about keeping the frantic pace of this speeder bike chase going on and on. And then it's funny because it transitions to this really slow part of Leia meeting this first Ewok and all that comes about from that. But for me, the speeder bike chase was a chance to give us, we needed a little action.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise this movie is real slow between the Sarlacc pit and the Battle of Endor. There's a lot of downtime, a lot of character development. And so you needed that speeder bike chase. So you needed another up-tempo sort of piece with the music and with the action of the movie.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And as I've said, this is one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So now we'll play Speeder Bike Chase and Land of the Ewoks.
Thank you.
So the last cue I have to play is one of my favorite cues from Return of the Jedi. The cue is brother and sister, father and son, the fleet enters hyperspace. I love how this cue is so complicated to start, and then we get the excitement of the fleet entering hyperspace. So what do you think about this cue, and what do you think it means for part of the movie?
Well, I mean, and this is really, you know, the fleet entering hyperspace is setting up, but the brother-sister, how is it worded? It's brother-sister.
Brother and sister, father and son, the fleet enters hyperspace.
So for me, this is what the whole trilogy is about.
Yeah,
and it is the relationship between, you know, Vader and his children and their relationship with each other. I mean, we see when we watch this trilogy, the movies are about Luke, by and large. It's the hero's journey, but ultimately the whole story is really about Anakin Skywalker and Darth Vader, and it's about his redemption in the end through his children. But we can look at the end, we can say Darth Vader is an evil character. Anakin Skywalker became evil, like as evil as you can get, like going through lightsaber and younglings, that's evil.
Yeah.
And that at the end, in the sense that he saves Luke, for Luke to be able to go on and do things, you know, I can't look at that and say, is Darth Vader redeemed for every evil thing he's done? I'm gonna say no.
Yeah.
But by allowing Luke to go on and doing all this other stuff, whatever else he does with his life, and saving the rebellion and everything, does he gain some measure of redemption? Okay, I can give him that. But this is ultimately a movie about a family and their effect on, through their relationships, on the rest of the universe. And so for me, that's what this is trying to get this emotional aspect of, you know, Luke's going into his meeting with Vader, trying to bring him back to the light side, trying to turn him back into good, trying to turn him away from evil. And it would have been super easy. And a lot of us would have just said, you know what? Hey, Dad's evil. Like, it's just time to let that go. Like, he's never not going to be evil, okay? So so for me, that relationship and everything is what the movie's all about.
Yeah.
And everything, you know, everything else is just the action around it. So for me, even the fleet coming in the battle, listen, I love that battle. I love it's a trap. Like, I love everything about that battle. But the movie's about this relationship between Vader, Luke, and Leia. That's what the movie's about.
Yeah. And one thing, I mean, I won't be playing the cue, but there's a scene in the movie when the Emperor is electrifying Luke, and mm-hmm. Vader realizes that he needs to make a decision, and he decides correctly. But at that very moment in the music, the Jedi theme is brought out, and you notice it just a little bit to where he's lifting up the Emperor and throwing him down that tunnel, or the chasm, I guess. And
right.
And it's a heroic point in the film that shows, yes, you know, there was some good in him, and he was able to, you know, fulfill basically that prophecy of having that balance set forth. But it just, you know, it's a very emotional cue as well. So before we play this last cue, one thing that I'd really like to say is I've enjoyed having you on my show tonight, you know.
Yeah, no, for sure. I've enjoyed it too. It's been fun talking about, I mean, a movie, and obviously Star Wars is, you know, Star Wars was going to always be iconic, even if Star Wars ended at those first three movies. Star Wars was always going to be an iconic trilogy of movies. And the first, you know, the prequel movies, while maybe us old timers don't like them quite as much, for a lot of the younger people, man, they love those three movies. And that's just continued on that Star Trek, you know, tradition. And now, I'll be honest with you, I think we're going to get a Star Wars movie. I think there's going to be a Star Wars movie every year until the year I die, you know, until the day I die, there's going to be a Star Wars movie every year. Because right now, Disney, they're just printing money.
Yeah.
And so I think we're going to get that for as long as people to go see them. And I think people are still pumped. People are excited about Episode 8. They're excited about a Han Solo movie. And so, you know, Star Wars is even more of a cultural point than it ever, you know, as much as it ever has been. And so it's fun to sit down and talk about that.
Yeah. So, John, where can people find you?
Well, right now I'm in my basement, but I am, so if they want to find me, they can find Worst Comic Podcast Ever on Facebook. We post a lot there of everything we've got going on. You can go to our website, worstcomicpodcastever.com, and you can find interviews we've done with different creators. If you're a Star Wars fan, you might go on there and find the interview we did with Jason Aaron,
who is
the writer of the current Star Wars series for Marvel. We interviewed him on the day that Star Wars number one came out. So you can listen to that. And I'm on Twitter. You can find me there as Comic-Con John.
Okay.
And so those are all places you can find me on the webs.
All right. So you can follow me on my Facebook page at Soundtrack Alley on Podbean, and then you can even write a review on iTunes for my podcast, because I've looked and there's no reviews yet. So
I will tell you, and you know, you're doing an awesome job. This is still a new endeavor. It takes people a while to find it. We've done 141 episodes and we still don't get. We get little messages from people. It's like, oh, I love your show. I listen all the time. And it's like, I've never heard of you. So people will listen even if they don't necessarily end up leaving a comment or a review. So don't be hard on yourself. That's part of the game. So a lot more people. I know podcasts that have 10, you know, 2,000 downloads a week. that will just tell me we don't get comments. Like, if we get 3 comments on a show, that's awesome. We feel great. So anyway, don't sweat that too much.
Okay. So I again want to thank you for being on my show. This kind of completes a trifecta of the worst comic podcast ever. I'm glad I was able to get Jerry on my podcast before he had to go into bionic knee surgery. So,
that's right. I messaged back and forth with him a little bit earlier today, and he's doing very well. He's doing some physical therapy, but he should be back. He had surgery on Wednesday. Tomorrow's Friday. He should be going home on Friday. So things are going right according to schedule.
Well, that's really fantastic. So again, to close with the show, we will play Brother and Sister, Father and Son, The Fleet Enters Hyperspace, and happy listening.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley, the podcast. I hope you take some time to review my podcast on iTunes and also listen to it on Podbean. And if you leave a review or rating on there, it'll help us get noticed on iTunes. Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley Spotlight. If you are on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review the show. Also, if you want to leave a comment, question, or concern, please email me at soundtrackalley@gmail.com and enjoy looking at my blog at soundtrackalley.com.